Welcome to Spotlight on Maryland Housing. I'm here with our Secretary of Housing in the state of Maryland, Ray Skinner. Ray, once again, good to have you in the studios.
Thanks, Mark.
We're talking about this. We're in a place where the market is maybe prime for new home buyers or home buyers in certain communities. But for a lot of people who saw the last experience in America and were hurt by it because they weren't prepared to buy a house, they were given mortgages that didn't really work for them. So preparing to buy a house seems to be key to the success in being a homeowner.
That's absolutely true, Mark. Buying a house is probably the largest purchase that the vast majority of us will make in our lifetime. So you need to be prepared. And it can be a really daunting kind of experience. So you need to do your homework and get as much information as you can. And what we recommend doing is, particularly if you're a first-time home buyer, we recommend that you attend a home buyer education class. And that will get you give you a lot of information about the home buying process, about different types of mortgages, about how to take care of your home once you get into the home, and so forth. And there are workshops that are held all around the state. We have a network of nonprofit housing counseling agencies that do what we call pre-purchase counseling. And again, these are for people who are about to buy their first home, and they can go to these education classes and learn about what that experience might be like buying your first home. Secondly, after you do that, you need to contact a lender and try to get what we call pre-approved. You go to the lender, give them all of your financial information about your employment and income and so forth, and they would determine what price house that you could afford. And then the third step would be to contact and select a realtor, a real estate agent, who would then take you around and to begin to
and
look
not
at
the
homes.
Other way around, which is where I think most people would start with a real estate agent and then go to the bank.
No, I think you want to be pre-approved first.
Right,
because
right.
What happens if you go out with the real estate agent, you find a house that you like and you're not approved, and then it's going to take some time. And during that time frame, somebody else can get the house out from under you. You can put a contract
right,
on
right,
it and
right.
get it out from under you.
But you also have to make sure that your credit is right.
Yeah, that's certainly another issue, and we certainly hear a lot about that these days. But having good credit can make the difference between getting approved or getting rejected, but it can also make the difference in terms of the rate you get. They may approve you, but if your credit is a little challenged, they'll approve you at a higher interest rate, and that can be a big difference in terms of your monthly payment.
So, again, how does your group department help with that?
Okay. Well, again, Mark, we have a program called the Maryland Mortgage Program where we work with home buyers and help them to get a mortgage through one of our lenders, and that mortgage stays with the Department of Housing and Community Development. But more importantly, the home buyer education that I mentioned earlier, that network of housing counseling agencies, we actually provide support, financial support, to those counseling agencies so they can do what they do, and that is educate home buyers on the process and help them get in the best condition to actually be able to purchase a home.
So they go to your website, go to Maryland Mortgage Program, and they can sign in and sign on to one of these classes to understand how to.
Absolutely.
Go about
on our website, www.mdhousing.org, there's a list of all the counseling agencies so the potential home buyer can select the one that's closest to their home, and they have a list of when these home buyer workshops are.
Sounds good. Secretary Ray Skinner, thanks again once so much.
Thank you, Mark. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this evening. We're about to have a conversation with Brian Kahn, who is another public radio man, except his public radio is out where the buffalo roam, as they say, in Montana. He's host of this award-winning program called Home Ground, Has many things been written in L.A. Times, The Nation, Field and Stream. He's been a boxing coach, a lawyer, conservationist, journalist, filmmaker. His book here is Real Common Sense, Using Our Founding Values to Reclaim Our Nation and Stop the Radical Right from Hijacking America. And, Brian, welcome to our studios.
Great to be here, Mark. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, too, again. As we were joking earlier, folks out there, that we met about 10 years ago or so at a public radio conference, and we were the only two public radio guys in the boxing part of the gym hitting the bag. So there aren't too many old boxers in public radio. What do you do?
That's right. That's right.
This is an interesting book, and it comes at an interesting time, and kind of fits my understanding of you and your work as kind of, in essence, a prairie populist. But, in some of the stuff you represent, at least from what I've been hearing, reading, and listening to. But it's interesting where you start, which is this book, Real Common Sense, taking off from the amazing Thomas Paine and Common Sense that the right, as you've written about, has kind of
tried to co-opt, yeah. I think, without either, if you give them the benefit of the doubt, you'd say sloppy research. If you don't give them the benefit of the doubt, you'd say it's deliberate. But Glenn Beck wrote a book called Glenn Beck's Common Sense, in which he praised Tom, inspired by Tom Paine. It said on the cover, but if Tom Paine was alive today, Glenn Beck would call him a revolutionary Marxist. Tom Paine was on the left of the American Revolution, and other people like Hamilton would have been on the right of the American Revolution. Tom Paine went to France, was an advocate of the French Revolution, although he was imprisoned there. And in, I think, 1792, he wrote a book called The Human Rights, the Rights of Man, Part 2, in which he advocated public works jobs, free education, pensions for the elderly, and was indicted for, and with a graduated income tax to pay for it all.
This is in the
1790s.
Right.
Of course, none of those things Glenn Beck believes in, and Paine was indicted by the British, he was a British citizen, for treason for writing that book. They never got to arrest him. But in any event, there's a lot of that stuff in the – I don't call it conservative. It's not conservatism. It's a radical reactionary ideology that in part is trying to gain credibility by, in my opinion, misrepresenting the founding values that Americans identify with. Part, you know, now we have to say part right. of the founding values, we had slavery in this country. It was recognized in the Constitution. I don't think any Americans want to identify with that part of free enterprise. But the founding values of that we take pride in as a people are reflected in two central statements. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read them.
I would love to have you read them. Go right ahead.
And you'll recognize where they're from. The first one is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, obviously, that's in the beginning of the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
This was written by Thomas Jefferson. And then this, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now, that's the preamble adopted in 1787. George Washington was in the chair guiding the Constitutional Convention. Mm-hmm. It was a revision, not a revision, a rejection of the Articles of Confederation, which had governed the country for 7 years, was a state's sovereign document. This created a powerful federal government to pursue, among other things, the establishment of justice and promote the general welfare. And when you listen to the debate, if you want to boil it all down, this country's always been at its best about liberty and justice for all, which is what we say in the Pledge of Allegiance. The right wants to talk about liberty, and what they really mean is, in my opinion, when you strip away the rhetoric, the emphasis is on the liberty to do any kind of business you want as long as it makes money without government interference. And there's no talk of justice, and this country's about both.
It's interesting to me how you blend certain things here, and you have a part of your book where you said it a moment ago, you alluded to it a moment ago, about the nature of conservatism, what for you it really means, kind of reflecting on your father and your father's family.
Yeah, my granddad was an automotive industrialist, and he was proud to be a conservative. He was a lifelong Republican. He has a long history in the family in the United States in which he took pride. He believed in handshake deal. He was an impeccably honest guy.
Mm-hmm.
He believed in tradition, social stability, law and order, property rights, free enterprise. He also believed he was a member of the community that he owed something to because he knew he was a privileged member of the community. He felt quick, honest money was a contradiction in terms. You earn money over a lifetime.
That's important what you said. Quick,
honest money contradiction in terms.
Quick and honest.
Yeah, that's not has nothing to do with conservatism.
Right.
And so people have, and whether you're a conservative or not a conservative, that's the history. It's a value-based philosophy that's got substance to it. I don't happen to define myself personally as a conservative overall. Some things I believe are conservative: personal responsibility, hard work, honesty, fine. But these guys have taken that label and wrapped it around themselves. And this quick money culture, anything goes, and no commitment to community. You see, that's the other thing. My grandfather believed in the community. He was a charitable guy. He took his responsibilities seriously. These folks really, I think, are sort of disciples of Ayn Rand, believe that the community does not, in fact, exist, and any attempt to protect community rights is an infringement on personal slash economic liberty. And you'll see that in some of the quotes I have in the book, from Ayn Rand down to the Tea Party Patriots.
Yes, you do. You tie that lineage very well in the book.
By the way, I should say, you mentioned I have a public radio show. My show's independent, so I don't work. It's an independent production. I'm not an NPR employee.
Neither am I.
So the congressional censors can relax.
It might make over. If they do cut the budget in a weird twist of fate, it could make programs like ours more amenable to other people that pick them up because they'll be cheaper.
You're an optimist,
free.
I can see.
I try to be. Not all the time. It's just, in here, you before we talk about the whole beginning of your book about where we stand now, mm-hmm. It seems to me you also, in the very early in the book, quote Adam Smith.
Yeah.
Who, now, the conservative, now that's
he,
like...
He's a demigod to the libertarians and some people who consider themselves conservative and some that are sort of free market libertarians. They like to quote Adam Smith, who was a contemporary of Thomas Jefferson. He was writing at a time of aristocratic governments. He lived in, I think, Scotland, a Scottish philosopher. And they like to quote him about the invisible hand of the market, which takes care of everybody, basically.
Right.
And Adam Smith also was a moral philosopher. And one of the things that he believed, first of all, he believed in a graduated tax system. And I've never heard that from the right. I didn't know it until I read a book called The Real Adam Smith. He also believed that the ethics of commerce were not enough to build a civilization. You had to have some other source, and he had language like the benign affections. You know, he was a literate sort of a guy. This current rendition of Adam Smith is they take part of it. Commerce leads to good things for people and therefore hands off. It's a distortion of Adam Smith.
It's interesting because, I mean, the conservatives and the right do claim him.
Right.
But you're kind of reclaiming him as well.
Well, I'm not. I'm just saying he was a much more dimensional guy than they quote. And he was a principled man. And by the way, another thing that is transparently false, Adam Smith argued, for example, the expansion of business by definition would raise wages for people because it's a supply and demand. And if you're in a small town in the 17th century, or the 18th century, he's writing late 1700s, there's a limited labor supply.
Right.
So it's going to increase the benefit to the laborers because they're going to have to pay more money. The right-wing libertarian commerce guys, I call them free market, quote, conservatives, because, again, I don't think they are. They try to make that – they're assuming that in a global economy where these corporations can go anywhere to get labor, that the same thing would happen. Of course it doesn't happen. That's why we've had all this outsourcing of American jobs. The companies have grown. They've gone over to China. They've gone to Indonesia. They've gone wherever they can to get talented, hardworking, earnest people to work for peanuts. So Adam Smith would say this is ridiculous. What worked in a small town doesn't work on a global scale. But they continue to cite Adam Smith.
Now, talking to Brian Kahn, his book is Real Common Sense. There are so many interesting pieces here, but let me jump back. I want you to describe for our listeners for just a minute or so your whole notion and idea in the first part of your book of where we stand now.
Well, I think we're in real trouble, not because we're bad people. I think we're all the same people. We've been on a 60-year credit card materialistic consumer culture binge fueled by television and easy credit. David Brooks recently wrote an article about it, which was interesting, talking about the cooperation between business and government converting from a manufacturing and export economy to a consumer and service economy. And Jeff Immelt, of all people, who is the CEO of General Electric, the largest corporation in America, was out in Montana for an economic summit meeting and said this policy was insane. We had to reevaluate it. Now we're 30 years down the road in terms of the export of American jobs. So what I'm arguing is we're all part of a culture wherever we grow up, and this culture has sold us for 60 years that the pursuit of happiness is owning consumer goods. And encouraging people to take credit debt, I can't remember the numbers. I'm going to say in 2007 it's about the average annual debt of the average family was 130% of their annual income. So we become a debtor individual society. Now, what is a consumer? A consumer is a person that's an individual frame of reference. And we are consumers. I'm not denying it. You've got a very nice shirt there, Mark.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. and I like old-fashioned wool clothes, in Montana, see? But we're not primarily consumers. We're parents. We're children. We're relatives. We're friends. We're members of a community. And we're citizens. Now, when you go back to the founders, these guys weren't consumers, okay? They were setting up a system of self-government, and I'm not arguing they're perfect. We can talk about the serious problems they had. But they articulated certain fundamental principles and ideals that I say has stood the test of time and that we have to get back to. And one of the central concepts in what I read there was you are a citizen in a community of citizens. Their basic principles involved human equality, human rights, human justice, a government of the people, by the people, for the people, in Lincoln's words, carrying out it. That is an ambitious charge they gave to the government, okay? And it's all based on a community of free and informed citizens with reciprocal obligations to each other. It's a fundamentally different frame of reference than consumer. If I've got a credit card in a high-tech world, I have the illusion that I'm independent of everybody else.
Right.
I don't need anybody. Just give me the credit card and do anything I want.
And you have the illusion you have money.
Yeah. Exactly, the double illusion, exactly right.
Right.
And so what we have is this situation where actually the conditions of life undermine, not by malice, just by the way it works in our society, which is 70% of the GDP is consumer spending in this country. It reinforces every ad you see that you're a consumer, an individual, and not a citizen. And I think it's a fundamental problem, and I have some proposals in the book, modest proposals, to use our mass media to sort of reclaim part of that airspace, which is the public's airspace, for helping us be reminded of that we are citizens in a community of citizens.
So one of the things, there's a great quote from your words you have early in the book that kind of is subtext for a lot of what you write about here, is wealth and power encourage people to believe that their security and welfare is independent.
Yes, I think that's historically the case. We're all blinded by our we have blinders. We all have blinders. We are influenced by our circumstances. And if you look through history, those with wealth and power believe that they can do what they wish and it's independent of the other people.
You posit something really interesting in this, though. And it's a really interesting juxtaposition, at least from my perspective in reading what you were writing. You talk about Ambrose's the great historian.
Yeah, Undaunted Courage.
Who I interviewed many times before he passed away. When he wrote about Lewis Clark and the rise of the myth of individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And you go through in the chapter and talk about we've gotten to the army of one as opposed to this older man you met in Montana who fought with the Marines and learned. It's
great to be part of the whole, he
right?
said.
So talk a bit about that. I mean, because we are so wrapped up in our country with this individualistic ideology and myth about who we are.
See, we're both, and that's the irony of the situation.
Both.
We are both. We are individuals. We're self-conscious. We're self-aware. It's natural as a normal, you can say mammal or whatever you want, a special, however you want to look at it. We think of ourselves. We think of our family. But we're also an intensely social animal. The only reason we survived for about 190,000 years of hunter-gatherer society in groups of 20 to 30 people was we developed a high ability to collaborate together as a team.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, the death sentence for tribal hunting-gathering people is you're out of here.
Right.
They just send you out.
Right.
It's over.
Right.
Because no one could live alone. It took intense ability to cooperate and collaborate. That's inherited behavior. Ambrose argued that in an interview that because Lewis had a mental breakdown, he never wrote his diary until many years later. And the American people then didn't get the quintessential story of this military expedition of comrades, as he called them, teamwork, guys who worked together impeccably as a team, going across the United States and expanding the liberty, the Empire of Liberty. And that The Virginian was a later novel that came out that was sort of the rugged individualist cowboy that's become a very strong myth in America. And so he argued that the national mythology emphasizes individualism as opposed to teamwork. When I said something about it, he said the West wasn't settled by individuals. It was settled by a group, the community, okay? And it's interesting. There's a quote of George Washington on the same point. He said, "The Constitution lays the foundation. It's up to the community at large to build the edifice." He understood this was not just about one person here, one person there. Let me give you another interesting quote.
Go ahead.
In the Second World War, Dwight Eisenhower, who became the Supreme – in fact, there was a book written by Stephen Ambrose called The Supreme Commander. It's a great book on Eisenhower.
Great book.
I found this quote in it written by Eisenhower, then general, to his brother in 1943, height of the war. We need to do a better job of teaching good old-fashioned patriotism, just that sense of loyalty and obligation to the community that is necessary for the preservation of all the privileges and rights that the community guarantees. Now, that is a very interesting statement because it's fully consistent with the founders. Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration, said, "A man has no natural rights that conflict with his social duties." They all understood free citizenship and the individual's liberty was tied to a community of free citizens with mutual rights and responsibilities and limits established by law for the good of the public. And I think our advertising culture now has exacerbated what was started back with the Virginian and the myth of the big four railroad guys, you know, who made fortunes with tens of thousands of laborers, et cetera, the building of the railroads with government subsidies. So
they couldn't have done it without government subsidies.
Absolutely. They gave them, if I remember right,
10 acres of land on either side.
10 square miles.
10 square miles, excuse me.
For each mile of railroad, they gave them 10 square miles of land. They gave them government bonds to guarantee the financing for this vast transcontinental railroad. It was a very huge subsidy. Of course, they couldn't have done it anyway unless Jefferson had used the government's power with questionable constitutionality to engage in the Louisiana Purchase, where I happen to live out there. I try to remind my Montana friends, you know, this was a big government purchase of land that resulted in our being there. So it's both. We're both individuals and part of the community in balance. And I think we're out of balance. We're out of balance.
Well, one of the things I really want to explore with you in this context of your book, because it is the constant struggle in America, whether it's the 1880s and the corporate giants that were created and built back then, who built steel and all the industries, the Carnegies,
right.
and the steel that they gave to the railroads, all kind of subsidized by the American government. Pushed ahead, built these huge corporations, and the power of that's always been this back and forth battle in America.
Yeah,
but they've always, in some ways, had the upper hand on some levels. And you quote people like Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Thomas Jefferson, and people who we all admire, think of as what America really is and what they represent. But they were also part of it. And so there's a lot of I'm trying to parse through your vision of what this power of corporations, which all these men have railed against, and their Americanness, and how that all plays out in the now. But we'll do that after this break.
You're an optimist.
I am. I try. Not all the time. Brian Kahn is our guest. His book, Real Common Sense, Using Our Founding Values to Reclaim Our Nation and Stop the Radical Right from Hijacking America. He's also the host of Homeground that is out of Montana. And we will be right back. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are here with Brian Kahn. His book is Real Common Sense, Using Our Founding Values to Reclaim Our Nation and Stop the Radical Right from Hijacking America. And by the way, Brian, right after this program, and as you're driving around and listening, go down to the Enoch Pratt Library tonight. He'll be there at 7 o'clock talking about his book, answering your questions. You get copies of the book. I'll be there as well, introducing Brian and do a little Q&A with him after he talks. So we want you to join us at the Enoch Pratt Free Library, on Cathedral Street downtown, and meet Brian Kahn and join our conversation down there. And you can enjoy our conversation and wrestle with it as we, for the next half hour here, as we are together. So when we left, I asked this question, and what made me think of this was reading your book. I thought about these huge money that people have made in this country, big money, and how Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, others railed against it. But their massive wealth really came about because of their partnership and with their fueling by the government, by our people's money.
Yeah, right? And you see, right, and you can say it was for the public good. In other words, they made a lot of money out of it. The railroads served the public good. The settlement of the West served the public good. The development of American industry served the public good. We have a capitalist, corporate, free enterprise system. I think what people should remember is that a lot of it was done with fundamental assistance of the government in multiple respects. That you could say is good or bad or neither here nor there. We have all benefited from that. In other words, the development of the industrial infrastructure was one of the fundamental things that led America to be a preeminent power. I think where we go off track is if we forget that it was a partnership between big government and big business, and Teddy Roosevelt, for one, came in and said, wait a minute, these companies are getting too big and they are controlling government. Let me just read you something from Teddy Roosevelt. Now, Teddy Roosevelt wrote this in 1910, 2 years after he retired as president of the United States.
And before he ran as progressive when he split the Republican
Party.
Yeah,
he was a progressive Republican, ran the Bull Moose Party. He says, exactly as this – now, this was written 45 years after the Civil War, so not that long here. You're going back to Vietnam for today.
Right.
Exactly as the special interests of cotton and slavery threatened our political integrity before the Civil War, so now the great business special interests too often control and corrupt the men and methods of government for their own profit. We must drive the special interests out of politics. For every special interest is entitled to justice, but not one is entitled to a vote in Congress, to a voice on the bench, or to representation in any public office. The Constitution guarantees protection to property, and we must make that promise good. But it does not give the right of suffrage to any corporation. There can be no effective control of corporations while their political activity remains. Now, again, that's a Republican talking. And if you go back further, John Adams, second president of the United States, right, letter to his son: no man nor corporation nor association of men have any other title to obtain advantages or particular and exclusive privileges distinct from those of the community than what arises from the consideration of services rendered to the public. So again, you have these guys' recognition of the interrelationship of the good of the community and of enterprise. And it's just, I think, at different points in our history gotten out of whack. And I think for the last 30 years, we've had a political philosophy that has emerged with Ronald Reagan as a very articulate spokesperson saying, government is not the solution, government is the problem. And you have Margaret Thatcher saying, there is no such thing as society. And you have the Tea Party saying, now I have to be careful, not the whole Tea Party, but the Tea Party Patriots website saying, we oppose government interference in the operations of business, period, and claim that it was the founders who held that philosophy, which they did not.
So when what you're talking about here in many ways, Brian Kahn, is the battle for the American soul.
I think that's a fair statement, and I think it's a conflicted soul.
Yes,
you see,
absolutely.
we're entrepreneurial people. And I really think it comes down to this. We're in a globalized economy like we've never seen before. Everything's interconnected. Something happens in China. Something happens in Japan. It affects the United States economy, vice versa. Entrepreneurship and business is tough stuff. One school of thought is moral principles have no place in business. Milton Friedman of the Chicago School is an advocate of that. Ayn Rand, the fountainhead, that she wrote a book, but she's the fountainhead of what I consider the radical laissez-faire right. Absolutely no moral values in business. In fact, she called altruism evil. The question is, do moral values and the ideas of justice have a place in the economy? And I'll give you a pretty simple illustration of it. Over the last 30 years of this deregulation, let free enterprise reign, trickle-down economics, that's been the dominant policy, and they want to go further now. What's happened? The gross domestic product of the United States has almost tripled from $5 trillion to $14 trillion during that 30 years. Worker productivity has gone up 88%. If you made $50,000 in 1980, after 30 years, you make $6,000 more. In other words, half a percent, an increase of half a percent a year. If you work for minimum wage, you're making 29% less money than you made in 1980. And if you made $1 million in 1980, you make $3 million now. Now, that shows you what's happened over a 30-year test drive of that philosophy, where there's no consideration, in my opinion, for what happens to everyday working people. People are working harder for less. Their benefits are, you know, their health insurance costs are going up. And people are under incredible stress. I think we got to find common ground between social values, ethics, justice, and business.
So when you talk about that, though, I mean, clearly you are saying that the marketplace and free enterprise are important to keep hold of in America.
They generate wealth. They generate opportunity. That's our system. That whatever you want to say about it, globalized economics, corporate capitalism is the system of the world.
But how do you balance? How do you balance that?
Yeah.
Between the other kind of quotes you have about from FDR and Teddy Roosevelt and others to control corporate capitalism, control wealth
okay.
and power.
How I balance it is Roosevelt said when private economic power is allowed to get – I won't get this exactly right.
I might be able to find it for you.
Okay. Well, becomes more powerful than the democratic state itself, you no longer have a democracy, you see. And I think the role of government – let me put it this way. Mark Roscoe, former Republican governor of Montana, became the head of the Republican National Committee. He and I were driving across Montana one day talking about this very question. And he's a raised Catholic with a long tradition of Catholic social teachings, social justice teachings. He said – remember, the market has no conscience. Now, that's a heck of a statement. And if it's true, and I believe it's true in the sense that it's not driven by conscience, it's driven by return on investment and profitability. How do you get conscience into the economy? It has to come from the democratic will of the people. It has to come from the people's government. That's the idea, in my opinion, that the founders had. That's the idea that Teddy Roosevelt had, that Lincoln had, that FDR had. And so it's up to the people through their elected representatives to bring, for example, the 40-hour work week, federal minimum wage, banning child labor in the 1920s. Those were constraints on free enterprise that were all called socialism, by the way, just echoes of this stuff today. Social Security. What's Social Security? It's a statement of principle that seniors, people who work all their lives, should have a secure and dignified retirement. That's not an economic value. That's a human value. That came from the people's government. And I think that one of the problems that we have today is the government, frankly, is run by the big commercial interests. There was just $4 billion spent in the midterms elections. $4 billion in the congressional. That didn't come from mom and pop.
Right.
Okay? Now, I want to make one other point about our democracy. I once held public office, Sonoma County Supervisor.
Uh-huh.
And I had a lot of opinions, and I got in a job, and, geez, there was questions of roads, mental health, social services, jails, land use planning, all sorts of stuff I didn't have the answers for. I had to ask a lot of questions. And what occurred to me was my job was really like being a judge. I had to listen to the facts and come up with a fair decision, my best opinion of what was in the public interest. Now, here's the deal. congressmen, senators, the president, they're all like judges. You go before a judge, you and the other guy, you got a disagreement. He's given him $100,000 for his election campaign. Do you feel you're going to get a fair shake from that judge?
I don't think
you
so.
You don't think so. That's
right.
Exactly what the situation is today. The oil, coal, and utility industries between 2009 and 2010 spent $500 million lobbying against climate change legislation. $500 million. Any of your money there? My money? No. Were we represented in that? They spent that money for a reason. They're pragmatic, and they think, in fact, they sidetracked the legislation. So we have a democratic republic that has now been warped by special interest, big money, that exactly what Teddy Roosevelt talked about 101 years ago. It has to be corrected or it won't work. The other aspect of this that's doubly troubling is when people see that the government's not working for them and they hear the propaganda from the right that government's incompetent, wasteful, et cetera, they begin to feel, hey, the government doesn't work. They become cynical and apathetic. They don't vote. They don't stay informed. In that situation, they simply leave the field to the people who know how to play the system. And we got to get out of that rut or we're going down.
Brian Kahn is our guest. Brian Kahn's book is Real Common Sense. Using our founding fathers, our founding values, excuse me, to reclaim our nation and stop the radical right from hijacking America. You're hearing him now on this program. In a short while, we will both be at the Enoch Pratt Library in Cathedral Street downtown. He'll be speaking there at 7 o'clock tonight, and we'll be doing Q&A together. I want you to join us down there at the Enoch Pratt Library tonight at 7 o'clock. So go grab a bite and come on down and join us. And going back to our conversation here, if this is something I wrestle with a lot, the stuff that you've been writing with. I think many people wrestle with it a lot. When you take a quote, let me give you some quotes here from your own book.
Uh-oh.
Be careful of hosts who actually read the books.
That's right.
Watch that. So you read this, I think, earlier about Teddy Roosevelt, the essence of healthy liberty has always been.
No, I didn't read
right.
that.
You want to read it? Want me to read it?
You go ahead.
One of the chief factors in progress in the destruction of special privilege, the essence of healthy liberty has always been and must always be to take from some one man or class of men the right to enjoy power or wealth or position or immunity, which has not been earned by his service to his or their fellows. That is what you fought for in the Civil War. That is what we strive for now. At many stages in the advance of humanity, this conflict between men who possess more than they have earned and the men who have earned more than they possess is the central condition of progress.
Pretty radical statement for a former president of the United States.
Yeah.
Running for president again.
Running for president again.
And I think, you know, that's nowadays the right would say he's talking about class struggle. I don't care what label you put on it. He's just talking about the facts that historically – through various systems, aristocracy would be one. Monopoly capital, the big trusts would be another. The slave owners would be another. People got more wealth and power than they earned, and they took it from people who were working hard and having the fruit of their labor taken away from them. My own opinion right now is it's not really what I would call a personal focus. I think the corporate structure that has served us so well in terms of producing things is out of control in terms of accumulated power. We created an institution, and of course you have to remember the corporation is a creation of the democratic state. It was created to mobilize capital in very large quantities to build things like the railroad and the steel mills that the biggest fortunes couldn't do. And so what they did was they gave immunity to investors. You can put in your money, but if the deal goes bad, if somebody commits a crime, somebody sues, you can't be sued as an investor. It's an immunity. You get a special benefit. It's been probably the most phenomenally successful institution ever created in the world, okay? And it's generated trillions and trillions of dollars worth of wealth. The problem is what Roosevelt identified, that is both TR and FDR. The moral of the corporation is to return investments to shareholders on a shorter and shorter time frame, but the basic concept, return investment to shareholders. They will do anything they can to do that. Those are the ground rules, so normal people in that system will do that. There's nothing in there about social conscience. There's nothing in there about patriotism. There's nothing in there about social responsibility. So you have an entity that is fueled with one thing in mind, and I think – personally, at this time, we have to redefine the powers of the corporations and the rights of the corporations.
Now, when you one of the things I thought about in reading this book a lot, you write about many quotes from Teddy Roosevelt, who I was one of my heroes as a child, and his fighting to limit corporate power for the rights of labor in many ways.
Which was surprising for him because he was a Republican.
He was a Republican, but he was pushed into that in some ways because he was terrified of the trade union movement pushing America to the left, and he wanted to try to staunch that as well as fight for the rights of common man. He had a double agenda going on.
Yeah, he was certainly no socialist. He was against the socialists.
Right. I mean, there was a time of Eugene Debs, who was a great American socialist party candidate. But then you talk about FDR, and FDR, his initial inaugural address, and his address in 41 about four freedoms, and when you didn't put in there, which is his last address, where he talked about the Second Bill of Rights, which was an economic bill of rights for all common Americans. But the thing they had in common was that the reason they took these positions in some ways, because they were pushed by masses of people.
Correct.
In unions and other places who made leaders look up to what the people want. Because Obama, our President Barack Obama, who many people voted for obviously in America, has many of the same flowery words and ideas.
Yep.
But he's being pushed by the other side so hard, and nothing seems to be pushing him in the other direction.
I don't disagree with you. I think it's a reflection of the dissolution of that side of America, which you can call a progressive, liberal coalition, whatever you want, that emerged very forcefully during the Depression and the New Deal led by the trade union movement. It combined socialists, communists, liberals,
populists.
Progressives, populists, and even some moderate conservatives
right.
to try to address these human problems with the collapse at that point of the global capitalist system, which was far less developed than this one now. So here we are in this current situation, and I think what's happened, the very success of the New Deal and the labor movement created a middle class in America. People were much more comfortable, and there was tremendous economic growth in real terms between the 50s and the 70s. We've had stagnation since the 80s. People have forgotten, in my opinion, their capability and power as citizens, in part because they become apathetic, in part because they become a sort of a consumer instant gratification mindset. You only have so much space in your brain to think about what you're going to do. And I think that for example, 38% of the American adults cannot identify the name of the vice president of the United States today. That's a recent poll. Well, that just shows they're not paying attention. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying that that's a consequence of spending too much time on entertainment maybe and not enough on your role as citizen. We got to turn that around, and I talk about different ways in the book that we can turn it around. But what you've pointed out is what's missing is an organized, like in the civil rights movement, those gains that I mentioned in the New Deal or the civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act, women's right to vote,
pushed from the bottom,
all pushed by millions of Americans who said this isn't right, we're going to change it. Now at the present time, you only have. In my opinion, and in terms of some level of vigor, you have a Tea Party movement that has elements of grassroots activity. Some of them are genuinely impassioned about the Constitution. I happen to disagree with their interpretation from what I see about the imbalance of that. But that's citizen action. I give them credit for citizen action. If people don't like where the direction is going, they're going to have to roll up their sleeves and get involved. There's no choice.
So talk a bit about where you think we go then. I mean, and what you start talking about towards the end of the book. I mean, that's to me in some ways what people are wrestling with right now is what do we do?
Okay, what do we do? I mean, first of all, we're not going to get out of this tomorrow. Either the economic morass of a consumer culture instead of a manufacturing culture. Or loss of interest in citizenship. I have a proposal, a modest proposal, I call it, to set up the American Values Fund. These are the public's airwaves. They're owned by the people. If you go to mine on public land in the United States of America, you pay a royalty to the federal government. I say let's charge a 5% royalty for national television advertisers. That's a $160 billion industry. That would generate $8 billion a year. That's 17 times the budget of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, assuming they survive the current Congress. We could do a lot with that money in terms of public service ads that would be designed at the local community level, not the federal government, state and local governments, nonprofits, using the same people who sell you cars now to remind us of what it means to be a citizen in the community. And that might be showing why it's kids going to volunteer in senior centers, old people, older people mentoring in schools, kids with quality family time, getting out in nature, a guy taking good satisfaction in a hard day's work, stuff that's about the real life of people and reinstilling the importance of being part and engaged in a community. Second thing we could do, we could produce world-class programs for kids, teenagers, senior citizens. We have to use television, in my opinion, not just for entertainment, but for education, where we are going to be the first generation now of Americans who are less well-educated than their parents. Mm-hmm. The first in American history. This is a colossal disaster in the making. Finally, I would say we could take some of that money. We've had the loss of more than 32,000 press reporters because of the downsizing of the industry. Let's take some of that money, have them hired by nonprofits, do good local news, string it out to the local papers and local radio stations so that people can get quality news instead of this entertainment news at a local level. I think those things could begin the process of reinvigorating our awareness that we are all part of a community. We're in this together.
Because that's admitting in some ways that you write about in your whole section on advertising and how we've sold America. We've all been sold this bill because of what we need, what we have to buy.
Sure.
It's all about me, 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 individualism, buy this thing you don't need. But it is the power of the marketplace, the power of the media that really can change, that just changes minds. It alters thinking.
No, there's no question about it. When I say it's $160 billion, it affects people's self-perception. And this is a fundamental question. I just read a biography of George Washington. I recommend anybody. It's called Washington by Ron Chernow. You read that 800-page book.
Yeah.
Tom Paine's book, Common Sense, depending on which history you read, sold 100,000 to 150,000 copies with a free population of 2 million in the United States.
Imagine that.
In a six-month period of time. Now, that tells you if people, farmers were reading it in the fields, okay? Washington read it to his troops. It mobilized the nation for independence. That's citizenship. Now, there was a heck of a lot of Tories around it. That's another thing that comes through in that book. There wasn't just everybody root for George Washington. But the point was people defined themselves as citizens. They cared about their future and the common good and the community, along with all our human foibles, okay? All of that's part of the picture. And it's inconceivable to me that we can change our perception of ourselves without using the basic systems of mass media, which, in my opinion, are warping our perceptions of ourselves.
Now, one last thing before we follow up. You see, you have that newspaper on your lap there. And one of the things that I was thinking about was here you have Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan putting out this budget to take away everything the government does. Not by and for the people, but for the corporations. They take it all away. And then on the other hand, you have Wisconsin the other day voting by a squeaky margin to throw out a right-wing chief justice in response to Governor Walker and putting in a much more progressive woman. So here I have this Wisconsin. You have these tail ends going on. That's what we're facing right now.
Yeah, and I think it's a wake-up time. It's a wake-up time. One of the things about the right – they're very confident in their views. In my view, if you listen carefully, you'll never hear the word justice, and that's because the idea of justice, human equality, economic justice are not values that they hold. The combination leads them to go too far and to do things that violate the American conscience. And I can just tell you from being in Montana, which is a rural, traditional, rural conservative state, honorable conservative people as well as liberal people, but not the quick buck crowd, okay?
Right.
That people still care about fairness and justice. And I think when things happen like the emasculation of the unions in Wisconsin, that if that doesn't get people's attention to say, you know what, we got to get involved. We got to start rethinking where we're going as a country. Because one thing about corporate capitalism, it creates immense wealth and immense opportunities. And it obviously creates immense wealth for people at the top. Okay? I mean, it's just phenomenal. 1% of the American people own 34% of all the wealth in America, more than 90%. That's more than is owned by the rest of the 90% of the people, the lower 90%, okay? 1% own 34%. So it produces wealth for the very wealthy. The question is, can it produce an adequate standard of living for everybody else that makes the system work, the millions of Americans, the 7 billion people in the world? Americans right now, 100 million Americans, one-third of Americans, live on less than $40,000 a year for a family of four. Think about that. Try to do that in your head.
Yeah.
45 million Americans live on less than $22,000 a year. These are working people for a family of four. Can this system, which produces all this wealth, provide basic nutrition, housing, medical care, pensions, decent wages, or not?
Can it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. It's a new system. But if we don't ask the question and push through the democratic process to explore what can be done, like raising minimum wage to living wage, there are all sorts of proposals to consider, we aren't going to succeed. We will not succeed as a civilization. You cannot have a separation that vast, and that's just in the United States. 1.4 billion people, that's about one out of five in the world, live on less than $1.25 a day. We're seeing in Europe, and not Europe, excuse me, in Egypt and the Arab world, the volatility that comes when young people don't have work opportunities and aren't treated with respect by a democratic government. Those are part of the global system of our economics. It will not stand, in my opinion, unless we find ways to have justice as part of our economic system.
Well, I really enjoyed this a great deal, and I want to encourage first our family, our citizens, our listeners to join us tonight at 7 p.m. at the Enoch Pratt Library on Cathedral Street. Brian will be there at 7 o'clock talking about his book, Real Common Sense, Using Our Founding Values to Reclaim Our Nation and Stop the Radical Right from Hijacking America. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at Enoch Pratt Free Library. You can join us both there. I'll be doing question and answer with him, but Brian will be speaking about his book. And Brian Kahn, thank you for pushing America with your book.
Thank you, Mark. You still look in great shape.
For old man.
Both of us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I want you all to stay tuned because when we come back from this very brief break, after talking with Brian Kahn, we'll be talking to Josh Fox about his documentary Gasland, about fracking in America and what it's done to people out west and all around and what they're talking about here in Maryland, that same debate. Then we talk to Zia Hamas about his wonderful cousin who was just assassinated in Jenin, who we've been talking about a lot this week, Giuliano Meir Hamas, and remembering his legacy. All that coming up in the next hour, so stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you. Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.